Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Sports Tonight on BSL Radio. Join Rob Shields and Mike Weber as they talk about the Baltimore Orioles, Baltimore Ravens, University of Maryland Terrapins, and more. Be part of the show. Call us at 347-215-8391.
Welcome to Sports Tonight with Rob and Mike. Mike Weber here with Rob Shields. Tonight we have Dylan Atkinson joining us in about 20 minutes from O's Uncensored. So talking some O's baseball with him. It's been a while since we've really gotten into the Orioles. Of course, part of that is because not too much has happened this offseason, but there is, the Dan Duquette saga to get into, along with some other O's topics. Maybe we'll get into a little Terps basketball. They've had a nice resurgent season, but disappointing of late. But the main storyline, of course, is the Super Bowl. It was a remarkably good Super Bowl. Obviously, the Patriots prevail. We have a very controversial final play to get into. Well, not final play, but just about final play there with the Russell Wilson interception at the one. Patriots win 28-24. They had a nice fourth quarter comeback, outscoring the Seahawks 14-0. So let's just get right into that game, Rob. I guess we can save the final play talk for a little bit later because, I haven't had a chance to see a ton of the analysis on this, but like at least post game Super Bowl night, and then what I have heard and seen since then, it's like 90% is like on that play, and I feel like maybe the rest of the game should be talked about a little bit. So let's start off with the rest of the game. Any thoughts on that before we get on to that final play?
Well, I have to say I was totally shocked with how the game played out. I did not think that New England would be able to do what they did. Now, what they did, what happened for the first three quarters is kind of what I expected. What happened in the fourth quarter, I was very surprised. When that game was 24-14, I had made a comment on the Baltimore Sports and Life message board that, once they got the touchdown at the end of the first half, which was huge, and then they came back and they marched down the field, but they got held to a field goal, which was a really big deal. The play of Ninkovich. That tackle on Marshawn Lynch, I think it was on third down, that forced the field goal. That was a big play in that game. They forced him to a field goal, but it's 17-14. And then New England goes 3-and-out. You could start to feel that Seattle was starting to take the game over. And then they get another touchdown, so now they're up 10. I thought for sure that it was over at that point. And not only did I think it was over, I just thought that that the doors were going to come off of that game, and that Seattle was just going to run away and hide, which is exactly what I thought was going to happen before the game was played. But Seattle, after they got that 24th point, after they got that, their offense just stopped. They just didn't do it. Now, credit to the Patriots defense, and the one thing that we saw in that game was those receivers are not good. Now, they did end up making some plays. Matthews made some big plays and all, but generally speaking, they weren't able to get really any separation, and Seattle wasn't really able to do a ton they weren't able to get open, so there were sacks, and they just weren't able to do a ton through the air. Let's face it. Some of the big plays, everything was trying to just kind of like go downfield, and, I don't want to call them lucky catches because I don't think that's not doing it justice. The guys made they made an attempt, except for the last catch where the guy was on his back. But, they weren't lucky catches, but, they weren't easy catches, and the ball was just kind of thrown up in the air and everything else. So there wasn't necessarily separation. It was just, it was just a good catch. But, if you look at Seattle, once they got to the 24, their next possession, they punted after four downs. That was at the end of the third, and then once you get into the fourth, sorry. It was a three and out, and then it was another three and out, and you know, and then they had a seven play drive. They had a seven play drive where they didn't end up getting anything because of the interception at the end of the game, of course. So, you know, they didn't really do anything, and that was huge. That's what nobody is really discussing, in my opinion, is how Seattle just kind of stopped doing anything. And one play that I thought was maybe the game changing play was the pass that Russell Wilson threw. I don't think it was Baldwin.
I think it was Curse.
But it might have been. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, Curse. And he dropped it. Now, it wasn't an easy catch, but it's a ball that he should have caught. And that was about a 30 or 35-yard pass, if I remember correctly, and it would have put them down in field goal range, and then obviously it would have been a first down and everything else. I think if he catches that, that ends up being at least a 13 and maybe a 17-point lead at that time. But the fact that he dropped it, and then they had to punt, and you know, and things like that, it kind of started a little bit of momentum for New England, and Seattle surprisingly was never able to stop it. I was very surprised that, you know, New England didn't run it well. They just were able to pass on them all day. Now, they didn't go downfield. It was just dinking and dunking. But Seattle, they didn't tackle well in the secondary. And, you know, I would also say, and I heard some guys on ESPN talking about this yesterday, and I think they're 100% right. I don't think they ran the ball enough. Yes, Marshawn Lynch ran the ball more than Russell Wilson threw it. But the bottom line is Lynch should have ran it more than he did. There was no reason for him to only have 24 carries in that game. He should have had 30 carries in that game, especially when they're up 10. You know, they're still throwing the ball, and you know, they should be pounding it with the run. And I don't think that they ran it enough, and I think that was kind of a poor game plan. And then every pass play, yes, they had a very high yards, you know, per completion. But, you know, it's like everything was, like, way downfield. There was nothing – they weren't doing anything short like New England was. They weren't trying to – they weren't moving the chains as well where they could have, you know, get the 3- and 4- and 5-yard passes and make it a shorter on third down. So I was really surprised about just how everything went down. And, you know, much like the Ravens game, New England was able to move it, but to their credit, when they got in the red zone – they got it in the end zone. You know, again, just like the Ravens game, if Seattle stops them one time and holds them to a field goal one time, it's a tie game and who knows what happens. You're not losing that game if you hold them to a field goal. Well, you're not losing it the way it happened. But they weren't able to do it. And, you know, that was the difference between New England winning the Super Bowl and losing to the Ravens, was their ability to, once they got in the red zone, to convert it into touchdowns and not field goals. And that was a huge part of their entire postseason.
Yeah, so you hit on multiple good points there. Now, as far as the running attack for the Seahawks, I mean, it was effective. It wasn't, like, you know, amazingly effective, but it was effective. I think they had a pretty, you know, reasonable run-to-pass ratio. I mean, they ran the ball 29 times, converted to 21 passes. Now, one to two of those runs were not designed by Russell Wilson, but still, that's, you know, that's a pretty good ratio in terms of running the ball. And, you know, early on in the game, they just couldn't get anything going offensively. You know, Marshawn didn't have a great deal of effect running the ball. And then, you know, throwing, Russell Wilson didn't complete a pass for forever. In terms of, you know, going downfield versus shorter passes for the Seahawks, I mean, they were obviously able to become effective going downfield. The shorter passes, I mean, what you talked about with separation, I think that was, you know, more of an issue on the shorter passes than the moderate to deep passes. There just wasn't a ton of separation generally with those quick short passes like the Patriots were typically able to get. Now, I mean, you mentioned the Curse drop, and I agree that was critical. Another critical play was, speaking of those later drives from the Seahawks that didn't result in anything, was a third down on, I believe, the next to last drive for the Seahawks, and their receiver was blatantly tripped. But not just, like, you know, tangling of feet. Like, the defender fell. I can't remember which defender it was, but he fell and literally stuck his hand out there to grab the foot. and tripped the receiver. And it should have been pass interference, or at least illegal contact, depending on when it occurred versus the throw. And nothing was called, and the Seahawks had the punt. So that could have been critical as well. But, yeah, I mean, I think the other key in this game was the injuries on the Seattle defensive side of the ball. So we already knew about, you know, the secondary being banged up going into the game. Turned out Cam Chancellor was more banged up than they let on. I don't know if that had an effect or not. I don't know if the Sherman or Earl Thomas injuries had an effect or not. I mean, they didn't really throw the ball at Sherman at all. He did miss one tackle blatantly, I think on the Patriots' first drive, and then maybe missed or didn't tackle as much as he would have otherwise, get quite as involved in tackling. But, you know, the injury to Lane, who was hurt on the ridiculously bad interception by Brady inside the red zone, was thrown into the end zone. I don't even know who the ball was thrown to. Lane, with the easy interception, got hurt on the run back. So that brought in Simon. So even though the Seattle secondary is excellent, depth-wise, not very strong at this point. So Simon was lit up after that. So, you know, he did make one really nice play later in the game on a deep throw where he might have actually been able to intercept the ball, but his left arm was literally held for like four consecutive seconds or something. But, you know, other than that, he had a really bad game. So that was huge. The Patriots were definitely able to take advantage of that injury. And then Averill was concussed. And that limited the Seahawks' pass rush after that point. So that really helped the Patriots' offense. But you got to give the Patriots credit. Like you said, they didn't get much going on the ground. Brady did throw the two interceptions, and the one that I mentioned was just absolutely terrible. But he was efficient otherwise, 37 for 50, very high percentage there. Not a great amount of yards per attempt, 6.6. Only sacked once, though, so you didn't have... Other than the interceptions, he didn't have much in terms of negative plays, and he was able to lead them down the field late in the game, obviously, for those last couple of touchdowns. So overall, a very good game for Brady. Not an excellent game, in my opinion, largely due to that, you know, that first interception was just so bad, and it took points off the board. That was a key interception. I mean, the Patriots, as we talked about how the Seahawks could have, you know, closed the door on the Patriots on the third quarter, early fourth quarter, the Patriots could have been off to a pretty big lead in the first half if it wasn't for that interception, and then, you know, if they were able to play better defense on that last, you know, like 35, 45 seconds or whatever, the first half, when the Seahawks were able to march right down and get a touchdown on, by the way, a very ballsy call there by the Seahawks with 6 seconds left from, I think, the 11 or 12, something like that, throwing the touchdown pass where there was a risk of the clock running out and not even getting the field goal. Now, they did have 2 seconds left to spare, but it's still a risky play, so give the Seahawks credit on that risk. All right, so unless you want to make, you can make any other comments if you want, but if you feel like getting to the Marshawn Lynch non-handoff there at the end, go for that.
Yeah, I just real quick for what you said about that, the touchdown at the end of the first half, I actually, if Seattle had won the game, I actually think a case could have been made that the turning point in that game was the Robert Turbin run that started that drive, because that was one of those, well, let's run it. If he doesn't get anything, we're going to go to halftime probably with nothing. But he got 19 yards, and it kind of got the ball rolling a little bit there. And that touchdown was enormous. I mean, if they don't get that, you know, I'm not sure how much of a game it is at the end with the way their offense was playing, but I think that kind of got them going. As far as the last play, I made the comment that, you know, I thought that Seattle had two timeouts, not one. So I made the comment that you run Marshawn Lynch three times and, you know, you go with the idea you're going to score. They had three downs left. Because they only had the one timeout, they probably were going to have to throw it one of the three downs if it got to the full four downs. That makes it a little bit more of a defensible decision, but first of all, I think the play call was poor. If you're going to throw it, then why are you not doing play action, or why are you not, like, kind of doing a bootleg with Russell Wilson and giving him the ability, if he wants to, if he can run it in, then he can run it in. I think it was a bad play call, and I think, and Mike Golic brought up a point this morning that I hadn't really considered. If Lockett catches that ball, he probably still doesn't score, because Butler was right there and he knocked him back when, you know, when he intercepted the ball. So and the ball probably would have been more into Lockett as well, so it would have been even more difficult for him to get to the end zone, because if it was out in front of him a little bit more, maybe he could have broken the plane with it. But I actually don't even think they score a touchdown on that play. And if you make a play, and if you're going to throw the ball in that situation, not only do you need to make sure that the guy is open, he should be in the end zone. He shouldn't have to then catch the ball and still basically run that yard to get in. So I think it was a really bad play call. You know, if you, like I said, you know, you want to do a play action. I mean, it worked earlier in the game. I still think they should have ran it. Herman Edwards broke it down yesterday morning, and actually so did Jeff Saturday, both of them on Mike and Mike. They were talking about, had they done kind of like their read option to the left, They kind of showed it where everything was one-on-one on the left, and the only guy who could have tackled Russell Wilson, unless somebody made some miraculous play, but basically the only guy that could have tackled him was Dante Hightower, who was about 10 to 15 yards away, and he was more in like the middle of the end zone. So it would have been a very difficult play for him to make. Now, of course, you don't necessarily know 100% how everything's going to play out when you're, you know, once the ball is snapped. But generally speaking, whether you're throwing it there or not, you know, whether you have to throw it or not, you run it on second down. If you don't get it, you call the timeout. Then on third down, then you can. That's the down where you can maybe then throw it, because it's in. Hopefully for the Seahawks, it's either a touchdown or it's an incompletion. Now, I guess in theory, you know, maybe they don't get in the end zone and that makes it difficult. But the good news is everybody is already at the line, so you should be able to get to the line and hike the ball very quickly. So while you did have to throw it one time, I don't think you throw it that way, and I don't think that second down is the down that you throw it. What's funny is we were watching the game, and my wife was like, oh, you know, when Lynch didn't get in the first time, I was like, it's okay. He's still going to get in. Let the time roll off the clock. That way New England doesn't have a chance to get the, you know, to get the ball with, you know, a minute left or anything else. And then of course, that happened. So, you know, Russell Wilson, you know, he deserves some blame for throwing the pick. I don't necessarily know that it was a really bad throw by him. Lockett looked like he could have ran a crisper route. He could have ran it a little bit more aggressively than he did. So maybe, you know, Wilson threw it where he thought Lockett would be. But, you know, so he deserves some of the blame. Obviously, he's the one who threw the ball. But that's a timing play. Get it out. You throw it to where you think the guy's going to be. So I do think that one of the things lost in all this is the kid Butler made a great play, and I do think he deserves credit for that.
Yes, fantastic play by Butler. That's a play, that route combo with that set defense, because it was just two guys, two receivers out there, and then the two DBs with, you know, no real help. And, you know, they ran what was should have been, you know, basically a pick to get Lockett open. And Butler just instantly broke. And, you know, typically the DB is not going to pick that either. He's going to get a hand on it or whatever, hit the receiver, break it up.
Right.
He's not going to actually come away with the ball. So very, very impressive play. I said the same thing when Marshawn Lynch got tackled. I was like, it's probably not that big of a deal. It might end up helping because he didn't take the clock down. And then I was surprised that Belichick didn't take a timeout. But that ended up working in the Patriots' favor, obviously, because then the Seahawks were left in the conundrum of, all right, well, if we don't get it in on a first run, then the time is really going to be an issue. So, you know, that was, you know, ended up working out in the Patriots' favor. Plus, you know, the Seahawks, you know, they basically got into a situation where the Patriots' defense dared them to throw the ball. They were, you know, mostly a goal line defense set up. They had, you know, the Seahawks did not have really the proper amount of blockers for, you know, a typical run play, because again, they had four receivers. And the Patriots had their four guys on those four receivers, but otherwise, the Patriots were not respecting the pass at all. All other seven guys were, you know, basically in the box, where you only have then the five offensive linemen to block those seven guys. So, you know, that was an issue in terms of running the ball. You know, I would say you put faith in that, but the clock is a concern. The play call, you know, generally I think that play call worked. So Butler made a great play. Russell Wilson, I think, it's hard to criticize too much in this case, but ultimately that throw probably needs to be more on the body or back shoulder, a little lower, to make it less risky. If you throw it in front of the receiver where he has to stretch his arms out, then it becomes a situation where it could be picked off like we saw. If it's more to the numbers or closer to the back shoulder, it's not getting picked off in all likelihood. So I guess that's one criticism of Russell Wilson, but it's basically just a situation where he gets the snap and that's the throw, instant throw. It's not like a whole big reading of the defense or anything. And so I can't criticize too much. But, you know, ultimately, I thought it was a terrible decision instantly not to run, but then thinking about it more, I mean, I still, you know, think it was a bad decision, but I'm not going to quite hammer them as much as maybe I was thinking of at the time. I mean, that's going to be, you know, all-time historic play, one of the biggest plays in NFL history. But let's transition to some baseball here. Well, I left them on hold for a little bit. Dylan Atkinson from O's Uncensored. How you doing tonight, Dylan?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Not bad at all. So thanks for joining the show. Yeah, no pleasure. Our pleasure. Let's get into the Dan Duquette situation first off. This has been, you know, a kind of a saga for this offseason. And really, there hasn't been a whole lot to talk about this offseason other than this, because not much has happened other than when they, you know, lost initially Markakis, Nelson Cruz, and then Andrew Miller. There hasn't, you know, been a lot of activity. So this situation, some people blame that lack of activity on this situation with Dan Duquette being recruited potentially by the Toronto Blue Jays and him having interest seemingly in that job for the CEO there. So, and then obviously the Orioles were not able to reach an agreement with the Blue Jays in terms of compensation. Who knows if this is really over or not, and if it is over for this offseason, if it will resurface next offseason. But what is your overall take on this situation? How much, if at all, it's affected this offseason, and, you know, how worrisome it is for the Orioles going forward?
I mean, I feel like the situation could have distracted Dan Duquette a little bit. Whether or not the Blue Jays tampered with Duquette, nobody knows to be sure if they contacted him or not. But overall, in order for him to get the recognition, to get the promotion to be a CEO and president of not only the Blue Jays, but any organization that may have interest in him, more than likely he's going to be trying to do the best at his job. Because if he's not doing the best at his job, then who's going to want him to be their president?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no question about that. It's just, I guess the question ends up being, even if he's doing his best job, you know, is everybody else in the organization worried that, you know, he still is thinking about something else, that he's got one foot out the door, and maybe there is some animosity between other members of the front office and him? I mean, I think that's the bigger question, because I don't think that he's going to tank, you know, being the GM of the Orioles or anything. I mean, you know, who knows? By this time next year, you know, maybe Toronto has gone with somebody different. Maybe Duquette has decided that he wouldn't even want the job anymore. I mean, a lot can change in a year. So I don't think that he would do that. The question ends up being to me is how does it affect everybody else around him? And I think that was the real question for the offseason too, is, you know, did the front office not do certain things as an organization because they all couldn't get on the same page, and partly because of the Duquette going to Toronto stuff. That's the stuff that you know, when Rock talks about that he heard it was a toxic situation, that's the type of stuff that I think is a bigger concern, more so than just the day-to-day player movement. You know, did he sign this guy? Did he make that trade or not?
Oh, I definitely agree. I mean, if some people in the organization, in the front office or wherever, if they're saying – it's a toxic situation, and some people are wanting him out of there. It's definitely a not good feeling to have. I mean, even though the Blue Jays are bringing back the president for this season, I still think there's still going to be rumors swirling around the entire regular season about this whole Duquette thing, seeing if he's going to go there next year, seeing if there's going to be a compensation package to get him there next year. So no matter what, I don't think this is going to die at all, and I think it could make it even more of a quote-unquote toxic situation in the organization. I mean, it's not necessarily that he wants to leave here or that he doesn't want to be here. It's the fact that he just wants a promotion, whether it's with the Blue Jays or not. And that could definitely be bad news.
So now that this is over, and we still have some off season left, there is a guy that's still sitting out there that surprisingly is still sitting out there that could help basically almost any team, and that's James Shields. And right now the talk is that, you know, he could just get a 1 or 2 year deal. There was some talk of a 4 year deal, but for less than $15 million a year. The Orioles, obviously, they struck out with Ubaldo with his contract from last year, although, you know, there's still plenty of time to change that around. If you're the Orioles, are you making a run at James Shields right now, with knowing that if you sign him, you probably have to trade two of your existing starters?
If I'm the Orioles, I wouldn't make necessarily a ridiculous push for him, but if the price is coming down, I would definitely be interested, definitely want to start negotiations with him, because even though there are six starters right now for the Orioles, there's always room for improvement. I mean, you have Tillman, Chen, Galvin, Gonzalez, Norris, Ubaldo, maybe somewhere in that order, and you put Shields on top of that, sliding Tillman to your number two and everyone else down, it just makes everything better and makes you a more competitive team. And then if you're able to trade two of your starters, you're able to better your team even more in other areas in what you get back in return for those pieces.
All right, moving over to the offensive side of the ball. Or not side of the ball. I'm still stuck in football mode here. But, you know, they obviously lost Nick Markakis, Nelson Cruz. You know, now they have Diaza for a full year. They brought in Snyder as well. So what are your thoughts on this offense compared to last year's offense? And Chris Davis is a wild card, was, you know, terrible last year, and then was suspended at the end of the year for Adderall use. You have Manny Machado, and Matt Wieters obviously missed a good amount of time as well. So how optimistic are you about this offense outperforming last year's offense?
I still think it is a potent offense, maybe not as powerful as it was last season with Cruz hitting 40 home runs most of his career. But still, if you look at a full season from Diaza, you don't know what you're going to get out of him. If Pierce even puts in half what he did in 2014, that's still a bonus. If Snyder can build off of 2014, I like the chances with that. I got to imagine that Davis is going to be somewhere in between 2012 and 2014, maybe even somewhere close to 2013. Can't imagine that he's going to be anywhere near where he was last year again. I mean, he's going to a contract year, going to have a chip on his shoulder. It's great to have Manny Machado and Matt Wieters back for full seasons. But the thing is that with them not adding a good amount of quality pieces to this offense, they have a less margin of error. Pretty much when Manny and Matt Wieters went down last season, they had the pieces to build back up. They still had Cruz in the lab, still had Markakis and all that. With them not adding more pieces this offseason, if you have Manny Machado, Chris Davis, or Matt Wieters go down with an injury that sidelines them for more than a month, you may not have those key guys to come up and fill in their holes and produce in the offense like they would.
Yeah, so good thoughts. We're being joined once again by Dylan Atkinson from O's Uncensored. Dylan, Manny Machado, so hopefully we get a full year out of him this season. what are some reasonable expectations from him with the bat?
If he does stay healthy throughout the season, it's always a big if. I do expect great things. I only expect him to go up from here. I mean, he only played in, I believe, 82 games last year, and if he would have doubled that up to around 160 games, it would have averaged out the pace he was going, that he would have hit over 20 home runs. So either way, if he can continue on that pace and stay healthy for at least like 140 games for the season, I do think he'll be around a 280 clip, about 20-plus home runs, maybe even above 70 RBIs. If he stays healthy, I like our chances with Machado this season.
So, Dylan, let's move over to the pitching side of things. Touched a little bit on the starters with James Shields, but what are your overall thoughts on the six guys who are starting, and as of right now, who would be your odd man out in the rotation?
Ooh, that is a tough one. I mean, speaking from the Orioles side, they're more than likely going to give Ubaldo another shot back in the rotation, you know, because of his contract. But for me, Ubaldo is still the odd man out, unless he has an amazing spring training and proves to them that he deserves a spot in that rotation. Whether his contract says he's getting $50 million over the next 4 years or not, I really don't care about that. All I care about is who are the best five guys in the rotation. I would rather pay Ubaldo $12 million to go kick rocks than pay him $12 million to take away a spot from someone else who was way more deserving than him.
And if, I mean, like you said, they're going to give him that opportunity. I guess if he goes to spring training and he can't find the strike zone and things like that, then maybe they don't. But, you know, even a slightly below average spring training, Ubaldo Jimenez is in the rotation. So, you know, there's been talk of the Orioles. They could send Gausman down because he still has an option. There's talk of Gonzalez maybe going down the AAA or to the bullpen. If Ubaldo is in, who out of that would upset you the most if they're not in the rotation as we start the season?
That's definitely a tough one. A lot of it could come down to spring training. I mean, if Gausman comes into spring training and he just can't throw a strike to save his life, then I will say, okay, go ahead and send him to AAA. But if he has a semi-impressive spring, I do expect him to be in the rotation on opening day. You could make a strong case for anyone to leave or stay in the rotation. A lot of people are saying that's an easy pick, saying that they would send Gonzalez to the bullpen, which necessarily I don't agree with. He's been one of the most consistent starters for the Orioles over the past three seasons. His FIP doesn't really show for that. Been a huge difference between that and his ERA over the past 3 years, but he's pretty much just been breaking FIP because he just keeps coming back every year after every year. And like just like this past season, he posted a 3.23 ERA or somewhere around there. So I don't see how you can reason with sending him to the bullpen unless you bring in a guy like James Shields or something like that. But again, you can make the same case for almost anyone else. Right now, I can't really speak for myself because I'm not sure right now, but if I had to guess what the Orioles are going to do, I would say that they're going to send Gonzalez to the bullpen.
And then speaking of that bullpen, you know, obviously we lose Andrew Miller, bring Zach Britton back from, you know, as the closer. I don't know that we can expect another sub-2 ERA. You know, it's tough to as a bullpen pitcher to consistently do that. The guy in the pen that has me a little worried is O'Day because of how he ended last year. He was just brutally bad in September and October. So what are your overall thoughts on the back end of the bullpen and just the bullpen in general? It's a pen that's deep, but maybe we don't have a lot of elite arms out there. So what are your thoughts on the bullpen?
I'm worried about both O'Day and Britton. I mean, we saw Britton struggle a little bit in the playoffs, had the ball slipping out of his hands in the rain, whatever the cause was, but he just wasn't himself in the playoffs, which kind of reminded me of the 2012 Jim Johnson, who was great all year, struggled a bit in the playoffs, and then just went way downhill in 2013. So I'm definitely interested to see how Britain bounces back from the playoffs here in 2015. Pretty much the same for O'Day. I mean, I don't know if there's any kind of injury that he wasn't talking about, something was bothering him. But he definitely just not did not seem like himself. I don't know if he was fatigued or what, but again, just like Britain, I'm semi-optimistic about them coming back because of their track records, with Britain having a great year as a closer and O'Day being great for the Orioles ever since he's been here. But again, it's definitely a little bit worrisome that they struggled at that back end of the season and the postseason.
All right, Dylan, we'll get you out on this question. What are your thoughts on the AL East as a whole and where the Orioles stack up compared to the other teams? Obviously, the Red Sox, very active this offseason, headlining moves with Hanley Ramirez and Pablo Sandoval. You know, Blue Jays got Russell Martin. Yankees got Andrew Miller, of course. So, you know, pretty active. The other teams, not the Orioles so much. But what are your thoughts on how the Orioles stack up in this division?
I still see them in the top half of the division. Don't necessarily know if they're at the very top, but I still think that they're up there first, second, at the lowest third right now. I mean, yeah, the Red Sox made a lot of moves. They made a lot of moves to their starting rotation. Not really big moves to speak of, but it seems like they have a lot of threes and fours in that rotation, kind of similar to the Orioles, but a little bit less proven. With their signings of Hanley and Pablo, I mean, Hanley, I don't know how he's going to do in left field. I feel like any team that's going to be facing the Red Sox in Fenway are just going to be peppering him all day and all night long, and it's just going to be fun to watch him box the ball. That's just my opinion. Sandoval, he's not really getting any younger. He's not getting any thinner. So I don't know how well that's going to work out with them. I mean, I see him being their DH soon, but I don't know how it's going to work with him changing teams and everything. He's a bit of a question mark, but he does have a pretty impressive track record from over in San Francisco. So they are definitely a team to look out for at the top. Blue Jays, they made a lot of good moves to their offense, but I still don't see that good of a starting rotation there. Still don't see a quality bullpen there. I feel like their offense can put up numbers, but I feel like whatever offense is facing them is definitely going to put up around the same numbers. So, and then the Yankees, I don't really see them getting any younger. Seems like they had everybody over 35. So, I really see the Yankees third or below, and Tampa Bay Rays, they're the biggest question mark because they can do a whole lot with nothing. But it seems like they have nothing right now. So either way, where the Orioles are right now, still have a plus offense, still have a pretty good bullpen, pretty good starting rotation. I like the way they average out, and also to not knock down the defense at all. The defense is still great, which helps out the pitching a lot. I still like the Orioles around first or second place in the division, as long as everybody stays healthy.
All right, I like the optimism there, Dylan. Where can you be found on Twitter, and what do you have going on at O's Uncensored?
I'm about to head in the studio right now for our own podcast. right now, I just finished up an article on Miguel Gonzalez about why he should stay in the rotation, not really saying who should get bumped out, but just making a case for him to stay in. A lot of big things coming forward. We just got done talking to a couple new writers that are going to be joining the staff soon, and a lot of good things are going to be coming for us.
All right, Dylan, looking forward to those new things there, new developments over at O's Uncensored. Thanks a lot for joining the show.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Have a great night.
You too.
All right, that was Dylan Atkinson from O's Uncensored. Rob, any takeaways there?
I don't want to say a concern about the offense. I just don't think the offense is really going to be any better than it was last year. And with all the talk about everybody, when you would hear people discuss the Orioles last year, you would have thought that we were one of the best offenses in baseball. And I think we were sixth in the American League in runs. We were middle of the pack in OPS. We were in the bottom of the league in on-base percentage. Now, the slugging percentage was not bad because of the homers, but we didn't really have they were one of the worst teams in the American League in doubles. I think they were the worst team in triples. So I have some level of concern. Now, a guy like Diazza could help with some of that stuff. I really don't know what to expect out of him this year. I wouldn't be surprised if Diazza is a guy that at the end of the year we're talking about wanting to give a 3-year, 4-year type deal to because of all of the different things that he can do. And it also wouldn't surprise me if he's a guy that we're looking to cut in June. Now, I'd say it wouldn't surprise me if that happened. I wouldn't expect that to happen. But, I mean, if he shows that he can hit lefties, as he's shown in the past, and he's struggling to hit righties for 2 or 3 months, he could kind of get buried, especially if a guy, you know, kind of the opposite of what happened with David Lowe last year. David Lowe, of course, got buried because he played poorly in the beginning of the season. Now, Diazza will be given a much larger sample size and a bigger chance than David Lowe got, but just kind of that idea that, you know, if somebody else is playing at a high level and Diazza's struggling, he could kind of get buried a little bit and just kind of be your, you know, occasional starter, pinch runner, you know, defensive replacement type guy. So I think he's a big key to this offense in a lot of ways. You know, obviously we have to have, you know, Manny and Wieters, to me, have got to stay healthy. You know, they signed Nolan Reimold today to a minor league deal, which is that a big deal? No. However, if Reimold is healthy, I still expect that a healthy Nolan Reimold can be a positive player for a major league team. So, you know, the Orioles got unexpected contributions last year from guys after players got hurt. And, you know, there's a good chance you're going to need guys like that again to step up for you because of poor play or injuries or something like that. And Reimold is a guy that there is some semblance of a chance that he can bust out like Steve Pierce did. He's got the power, he's got the eye, you know, he's athletic. He's not a great outfielder, but, you know, he's good on the bases, he's got some speed. I mean, he brings some stuff. So, you know, some of these depth moves that, you know, that Duquette has done a great job of adding, you know, they're still going to be important to this team, I think. So if the depth guys aren't good and we have injuries and, you know, if a guy like Steve Pierce comes back to earth a little bit, you know, if those types of things happen, then I think this offense could be in a lot of trouble. But I did like the Travis Snyder deal. You know, maybe we gave up a little too much, but I you know, at the end of the day, I don't think I'm going to be that upset that you gave up a couple of top 15, 20 arms. You know, they're guys that you can probably always replace in the draft. So I'm not too upset by that. I mean, he could be your outfielder for the next couple of years. He's got some upside. So, you know, but he also has a lot of downside, as he's shown in his career. So, I the Orioles just have one of those teams. Again, it's the same team as we've had the last few years. Where are they going to be? Are you going to get the contributions? Are guys going to stay healthy? Is the bullpen going to be able to continue to stay lights out? I would expect the rotation to be still pretty good. I would expect the rotation, the bullpen to be pretty good. But if Britton and O'Day are 3 ERA pitchers instead of 1.5 to 2 ERA pitchers, how is that going to affect our win total? You know, are they going to be a little bit worse in high leverage situations? And because we're going to be playing in a lot of close games, does that cost us a couple of wins here and there that we should have, and therefore that could be the difference between making the playoffs and not? You know, those are the types of small things that I'm interested in seeing. So I would love to see him at Shields. I would like to see him trade a couple of guys. I like the fact that they have the bullpen depth, but I think the depth needs to be thinned out a little bit because you've got a lot of guys making some money. And, you know, I think you need to do they really should be making some moves. It's depth can be a good thing, but it's not always a great thing. And I think they should be making some moves. And I think adding James Shields, especially for the contracts that they're now talking about, is a complete no-brainer. You know, we had guys fall in our lap last year, and Shields is better than those guys. And, you know, the fact that he could be sitting there and falling into our lap again, that would be a pretty exciting move, even though he might not come out of the gate all that strong this year because he didn't have much of an offseason.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much I buy into the whole offseason stuff because, you know, he could still be doing whatever he would have been doing anyway for the most part. Mm-hmm. At this point, he makes some sense. I wasn't a big fan of, you know, going 5 years, $100 million for him. But, you know, at a reduced rate, lower amount of years, yeah, he makes some sense. And then the Orioles could flip a starter or two, along with maybe a reliever, like you mentioned, and get some additional talent. Maybe a position player that would be helpful, or, you know, or you could just get some young players that could help down the line. You know, in terms of the offense, yeah, Snyder, that's, you know, decent move. Nolan Reimold, got to like that move for depth. I agree there's some upside there. I've always been a fan of his. Diaza, I like Diaza more than you do. Maybe he has to be platooned. He was actually solid against left-handed pitching prior to last year, but last year he was dreadfully bad. So not sure what to make of that. But, you know, as you may know, Rob, I'm a pretty big fan of platoons, so it's not the end of the world there if he does have to be platooned. And, you know, maybe Nolan Reimold is a guy you can platoon him with potentially down the road, even though Reimold's not necessarily a platoon-type player. He can hit both righties and lefties fairly well. It just could be a situation where he can mask the weakness of Diaza. But, you know, so I'm pretty optimistic about the offense. The offense was 6th in the AL last year out of 15 teams, so not bad. They were also much closer to 3rd than they were to 7th in runs scored. So, you know, a pretty good offense last year. And I would think that this year they could be approximately as good. You know, you expect some, regression there from Steve Pierce. Obviously, you're losing the huge year Nelson Cruz had. Now, if you had brought Nelson Cruz back this year, I wouldn't expect anywhere near a repeat of that year. So that has to be considered in terms of any bitterness of losing him. Nick Markakis, you know, I think that's been pretty adequately replaced with the production that Snyder is probably going to have and, you know, Diaza for a full year. So I'm not overly concerned about that loss. And then, you know, Machado hopefully for a full year and Weeders hopefully for a full year. But, of course, you know, those guys have pretty much full years. There'll probably be injuries elsewhere. So hopefully, again, the depth comes through. And then, again, as we talked about with Dylan, Chris Davis, you know, you have to expect some sort of resurgency there. It's just a matter of how much better he is this year than last year. That's obviously a key.
You know, you mentioned Matt Weeders, and I think an interesting thing's going to be is, you know, Weeders was tearing the cover off the ball last year. And there was a big adjustment made when he was batting left-handed. His hands were lower, seemingly allowing him to get through the zone quicker. It's going to be interesting to see if that same approach, if he's going to continue with that and carry that over, and if he's going to be able to be an 800-plus OPS guy. He was well above that last year. And, you know, but he's obviously a key. I mean, if Matt Weeders is going to be in his free agency year, when you know he wants to have a big year to get a monster contract, if he all of a sudden is going to have a year where he's that 850 or 900 OPS guy that we all thought he was going to be, that really is a game changer for this offense, I think, because Weeders will probably have he's got a decent eye, so he'll probably, you know, have an on-base percentage that would be higher. You would assume that Chris Davis will have a better year. He's not going to probably have what he had in 2013, but, you know, if he can have a 350 OPS and a 500-ish slugging, on-base percentage and a 500-ish slugging, then you know, that's obviously a big year. I mean, those types of things could be real game-changers for this offense, and they could become a potential elite offense. It's just, to me, there's not a lot of margin for error with this offense, and, you know, it's going to be interesting. I would like to see Buck do, even though I know he's not going to, I doubt he's going to, but I'd like to see him do a little bit better job of resting Adam Jones, too, which is a minor thing, but I would like to see Jones get more time off so that he's stronger at the end of the year. Jones had had the best year of his career last year. The defense was better seemingly because of positioning and things like that. So his OPS ended underneath 800. It was in the 800s for most of the year. But, you know, overall it was his best season. So I would like to see him just rest a little bit more because this team is going to need him down the stretch. I just fully expect the same type of team that we've had. And, you know, that type of team has been very successful. And still the best thing about this team, and I don't really think there's much doubt, is the defense. That's not going anywhere. You might even be able to argue that our defense is going to be better this year than it has been because, you know, I'm interested to see where they play Travis Snyder. You know, Uzigar says that he's better in left field than he is in right field. Now, we'll see. You can make the argument that left field might be a little trickier in Camden Yards than right field. but that's been where he's been better. So, but generally speaking, the combination out in the outfield of Pierce and Diaza is a solid combination. If Jones is going to continue to play defense and position like he did last year, then he's a legitimately very good defender. David Lowe is obviously a good defender. Our infield defense is ridiculous. I mean, you've got three gold glovers in the infield, not including Wieters. So, the defense is going to continue to be a big reason why this team is going to continue to be a contender because it's going to make the pitching that much better. If this same rotation was pitching in front of an average or below average defense, this rotation would not be good. But because it's pitching in front of an elite defense, I think the pitching is going to continue to be solid. To me, it's who's the starter that's the odd man out? I hope it's not Gausman. And you know, are you going to be able to find the right seven arms out in the bullpen that will, you know, that can perform at a high level for you? I think we have the arms to choose from to do that. It's just getting those guys and then hoping that your two main guys, O'Day and Britton, don't kind of fall on their faces or implode or whatever, because I think you really need, you know, those two, because right now we don't have another back-of-the-bullpen arm that we can really rely on at this point, although obviously as the season goes on that could change.
Yeah, I think Hunter will have a better year and Brock has shown potential, but at this point, you know, one of the regrets I would have if I were, Dan Duquette would be Andrew Miller. I was, you know, very high on him, retaining him going into the offseason. You know, I was preferring him over Nelson Cruz and Nick Markakis, considering what contracts I was expecting all of them to get. Andrew Miller did get a hefty contract, but considering the lack of money spent and, you know, lack of activity, I would, you know, be very happy just to have Andrew Miller right now at, you know, the 4 years, $36 million or whatever, 4 years, even $38 million or whatever it would be to keep him. Since nothing else has happened, I would have been, you know, content at least with having a promising back end of that bullpen that could just be dominant like what we saw last year, and what really propelled, I think, the Royals along with their defense to get to the World Series.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a tough one. I will say this. If Andrew Miller was on the Orioles this year, I would feel better about the team. Now, I don't know that I'm going to buy that he's going to be as dominant as he was last year. Certainly, all the statistics tell you that he's going to be. It's not like he was lucky or anything like that. It's just a matter of, is the walk rate going to continue to be as low as it was last year? Because that's what's plagued him in his career. At the time that he signed the deal with the Yankees, I said, you know what, I think this was the right move, not matching or beating that deal. I had said, like, the max that I wanted to go was 4 years at $32 million. So yes, it was only an extra million, but like I thought $8 million a year was really pushing it. But I will say this: if you would have told me that they basically were going to do nothing in this off season, I mean, Travis Snyder was a move you can make whether you have Andrew Miller or not. I mean, he's making $2 million this year, so that's not a big deal. if you were going to tell me that they weren't going to do anything, I would have said, you know what, spend some more money and keep him. Because while I don't think he's going to necessarily be as dominant as he was, I still think he's going to probably be one of the better relievers in the American League and probably all of baseball. And having him at the back of our bullpen as not just to be the best pitcher, but also to be insurance in case O'Day and or Britton really struggle, that would have been a big deal. Now we'll see. Maybe one of the young arms, or maybe some guy like a, you know, that maybe, God, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but maybe a guy like Brian Mattis just has a monster year. It wouldn't be the first time a reliever's gone from sucking to really good. So maybe we'll have, you know, that third really, really dominant arm. I mean, it's possible. Maybe it's a guy that we're not even considering right now, like a Michael Wright or something like that. He comes up in the second half of the year. But I also think that's why it could be important that one of these starters goes to the bullpen and performs well. You know, if a guy like Miguel Gonzalez, if you send him to the bullpen, and he to me is the guy that you would send, because I think you have to give Ubaldo a chance, and because Gonzalez, out of everybody else, is the one who will struggle to go deeper into the games, even if maybe the time that he pitches is more quality than some of the other guys. But, you know, maybe a guy like Gonzalez ends up being your second or third dominant arm out of the bullpen. You know, that's possible, and that could be, you know, really huge for this team. So I think you like a lot of things about this team, but I think you also dislike still, like, you know, you're still relying on a lot of role players. Are these guys going to fit their roles? Are they going to struggle? Is this going to be the Travis Snyder that was the second half of last year, or the guy that was 3 years before that? You know, is this going to be the Steve Pierce that was okay in a certain role before, or is this going to be the guy that was, you know, arguably our best player last year? You know, those types of things are going to be the real keys to this team. And, you know, it's not necessarily a pitching staff and a lineup that you're putting out there when you're able to say, look at this guy, yep, if he stays healthy, we know we're going to get this, we know we're going to get that type of thing. We don't really know that with this team in a lot of ways. But overall, I think you should expect a very solid team. I would be surprised if this team is less than a 82 to 85 win team this year. And, you know, I think they've got that same ceiling of 90-plus wins. You know, I think it's going to be tough to win 96 games again, but I think it would have been tough to win 96 games if we added, you know, John Lester and Scherzer in the offseason. You know, the 96 games is a lot of games to win, and, you know, you need a lot of things to go your way and things of that nature. So, you know, the 96 wins is never going to be guaranteed for any team, but, you know, you want to put yourself in position where you're able to contend, where, you know, you can put yourself in the playoffs and that type of stuff. I wouldn't expect this team to run away with the division like they did last year. I think that everybody in the division is improved. We'll see with the Yankees if Tanaka. I don't know if Tampa's improved on the field, but they probably will still have a better record, I think. We'll see what happens with the Yankees and Tanaka, how much that is. The back of their bullpen is insane with Betances and Miller, so, you know, they're going to be, you know, seven, 8-inning games in New York if they got the lead, the game's over probably. So, you know, but you know, so I don't expect them to run away with the division because the teams are better, but, you know, I still expect them to be one of the better teams and, you know, have, you know, if you predict them to finish third right now, my guess is you're not predicting them to finish third and being any more than five games out going into the season. So, obviously, that's a lot of room for a lot of margin for error there where you could see them winning the division, because you're not saying that they're a 75-win team or anything like that.
Yeah, I think they're, you know, a good team, definitely has the potential to win the division. I'm not overwhelmed by any one team in this division, but at the same time, you know, the Orioles are just, they're, you know, they could be a very mediocre team for various reasons that you've stated and we've talked about before, and that's been talked about on BaltimoreSportsAndLife.com. But yeah, they certainly could be a 90-plus win team if a few things break right. And, you know, the Blue Jays, Red Sox, Yankees, Rays, I mean, there's no way I'm counting on any of those teams to win 90-plus. I think some of those teams have better chances than others. Red Sox, probably the best chance of that group. You mentioned the Yankees now with Andrew Miller, but you know, they had a super dominant back end of the bullpen last year too, and you know, they still weren't a particularly strong team. They just basically, you know, replaced one great reliever with another one, and you know, they still have plenty of issues, but they should at least have considerably better defense at shortstop, so that's a plus for them. Anyway, let's close out the show, talk a little Terps basketball. You know, they've had a good year so far. They're 18-4, second in the Big Ten. Not really any powerhouses in the Big Ten, though. Wisconsin's very good, but otherwise, you know, there's not really any particularly strong teams. There's a lot of decent teams in the Big Ten. So, you know, Maryland recently has struggled. They lost at Indiana 89-70. They barely beat Northwestern at home, came back to do that 68-67. Northwestern, not a good team. Then they got hammered at Ohio State 80-56. They got Penn State at home coming up tomorrow and at Iowa, and then home against Indiana after that before going back to Penn State. So, you know, the schedule's not super daunting going forward, but, you know, it's not easy either. So basically what I see, I don't really watch like any other college basketball besides Maryland. I've lost interest in college basketball in general. Still watch some Terps. So with that said, you know, this is a team that just does not look like that great to me. They didn't look, you know, as an amazing when they were, I guess they were, 17-2 recently. So they didn't look like a 17-2 team in a major conference. You know, it looked like they were playing over their heads a bit. And, you know, you had a schedule that wasn't super difficult for the most part. And they have, you know, obviously a very good freshman in Melo Trimble. But at the same time, you know, he's playing point guard. He's only averaging 2.8 assists and 2.5 turnovers. So that's not particularly strong. His field goal percentage is not that good either, 41.4%. Now, he does get to the line a lot, and he makes just under 88%. So that's, you know, a huge plus for him. Jake Layman has really stepped up this year. But otherwise, like, offensively, there's not a whole lot that they can count on. I mean, Des Wells is third in scoring, 13.5, but he's only shooting 40.5% from the field. And then there's no one else that averages 8 points a game. I mean, there's some guys, like, you have to like, I guess, what you've seen from Nickens and Wiley so far as freshmen. They're hitting threes. Got to like that. Evan Smotrich has been really bad. Dodd is, you know, he's shown some potential at times. He's done some nice things on defense, but, you know, Sikorski's been a very big disappointment as a freshman, considering all those interviews we, you know, talking to Jeff Ehrman and others, and, like, there seemed to be so much potential with this guy, and he was supposed to not just be, like, a long-term project. He was supposed to be, you know, relatively finished, and right now, I mean, he's averaging 3 points, under three boards a game. He just really isn't showing that refined skill that was talked about. So I don't see this team as, you know, a particularly well-balanced offensive team. They do have a good amount of three-point shooting, and they rely on that perhaps too much. They don't have anyone they can give the ball to down low. And, you know, Trimble can get to the basket. Wells can get to the basket. So they get to the line a fair amount, but it's basically free throws and threes. There's not a whole lot else going on with this offense. Defense, you know, seems to be solid, but, you know, nothing to the point where that can carry them, you know, through the tournament or anything like that.
Yeah, Maryland's an interesting team to me. I agree with you. I feel that they've been overseeded, and it's not any of their fault. Teams were losing, and they weren't. So, you know, that's what happens with the polls. You know, if you just keep winning games and, you know, the teams around you lose, you just kind of start going up the rankings. That's just the way it goes. Ken Pom right now has them 32nd. You know, they're basically, he's talking that, you know, they're a decent team. They're not a great team. They're not a terrible team. They're a decent team, and I think that's, you know, probably a fair assessment. You mentioned the schedule. The schedule for them going down the stretch is really not that difficult. I mean, you have Wisconsin, but you do get them at home. But I mean, you've got two games against Penn State. You got Rutgers. You've got two games against Nebraska. You know, you've got a lot of winnable games. I mean, you have Indiana next week. Indiana, you know, beat them at Indiana, but you get them at home this time. So, you know, you've got a lot of winnable games. I mean, I think there's a really good chance that the Terps end up, as a seeded somewhere in the 3-5 range, because I don't know that they lose more than you know, two or three more games in the Big Ten, and then, you know, they can go, if they can go deep in the Big Ten tournament, I mean, I think they're going to put themselves in good position to have a pretty decent seed. Now, the problem is this. The Terps are probably going to be a team, because of all the reasons that you said, that a lot of people are going to pick to lose their first-round game. You know, if they're not going to be any higher than a 3 seed, in all likelihood, unless they, like, kind of win out or something crazy like that. But they're not going to likely be any higher than a 3 seed. They're probably more a 4 or a 5 seed. And you're talking about playing, you know, a quality team in the first round, whether it's a mid-major team or whether it's a major conference team that struggled, you know, this year, but, you know, found its way in the tournament or whatever. So they're going to be a team, I think, that a lot of people will say, we think they're going to lose for the reasons that you listed. But they're also a team that is going to be talented enough that they could win a game or two in the tournament, I think. The Terps, for me, they're a year early right now. If Jake Lehman doesn't leave to go into the draft, and there is some talk that he could be a first-round pick if he left, and if Trimble doesn't get his head too big and he doesn't leave, if you're able to keep those guys and then you get Robert Carter that's next year, then I think Maryland is a legitimate good team next year. I think right now they are a decent team, a team that, you know, like I said, is capable of winning a game or two. I think if the guys come back, that this is a team that next year that they could be a realistic top 10 team. So we'll see. I would agree. I, you know, overseeded, not quite as good as what the record says, but they're going to be able to rack up a lot of wins in a conference that, quite frankly, did not end up being as good this year as people thought they were going to be. Michigan is really down. Nebraska, after having a good year last year, hasn't been that good. Michigan State is down. You know, Ohio State's not quite as good, although they're going to probably be able to. They'll probably end up as a team ranked in the top 20. So, you know, you've got some good teams, but you don't have the depth and the quite upper echelon teams that you maybe thought you were going to have as you went into the season. And that's going to allow Maryland to get a lot of wins, but maybe not necessarily put them in a great position to go deep into the tournament.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a lot of decent teams in the Big Ten. There's only one really good team. So, yeah, I give credit to Maryland for prevailing in the vast majority of their games against, you know, decent-ish competition. But, you know, if they end up like 25-6 for the regular season, 24-7, like you mentioned, is possible due to the schedule. I mean, I don't know that there would be I don't know if I would have seen many worse 25-6 major conference teams. I guess that speaks to the quality of the conference, as well as, you know, the quality of college basketball as a whole is not quite as good as when I used to really pay attention to college basketball more in the 90s and early 2000s. So, you know, I don't know. It's hard to get, like, super excited about this team right now. It's nice that they're relevant again, that they should be dancing come March, that they're, you know, one of the best Big Ten teams, even though, you know, I'm not incredibly invested in the Big Ten yet at this point. But all that stuff's very nice. And like you said, next year, this team, if those guys don't leave early, could legitimately be good. So that's exciting. I'm just not going to get, like, super optimistic about this season because, you know, while anything can happen in the tournament, we've seen that. This isn't, you know, a team that I would expect a whole lot from.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're a Terps fan, the right approach to take for this season is let's get in the tournament, let's get seeded well, let's get first of all, getting in the tournament and getting that monkey off the program's back is important. You know, people can debate whether, you know, if you get in the tournament, you lose in the first round, what good is that? But getting that monkey off your back, kind of getting a little pressure off of Turgeon, those are all important things. Being able to have a successful first year in the new conference, it's important. Even if the conference is down, it's still important for you to do that and to kind of set a tone for your program, you know, in a new conference. So all of those things are big deals. And if I'm a Maryland fan, you know, it's, you know what, we made the tournament the first year in the Big Ten. We were one of the top three or four teams in the Big Ten. We, you know, we got a top five seed in the NCAA tournament. I mean, those are all things that in the beginning of the year, before this season started, if you had said, these are the things that you guys are going to have this year. Now, you may not go deep in the tournament, but you're going to have those things. Every single Maryland fan would have said, okay, that's great. That's a heck of a start. Let's do that, and then next year we're really putting ourselves in good position. So I think that's kind of how you have to look at it. And if Maryland does surprise some teams, as you said, things happen in the tournament. You know, they get hot from three, you know, something like that. You know, all of a sudden maybe you can make a Sweet 16 run. And it wouldn't be, you know, there have been worse teams that have made the Sweet 16 than what Maryland is this year. So, you know, but you go in, but you have a lot of positive things going on with this team right now. And I think as a Maryland fan, this is the best you've had to feel for quite a few years, given the way things have been lately.
No doubt. Definitely looking on the upside here in terms of Maryland basketball. Things are improving, and next year hopefully will be even better. And, yeah, again, maybe they will make a run. If they finish 25-6 in the regular season, you could be looking at a team that, you know, is seeded to have a very good chance at making the Sweet 16. So we shall see. But, you know, I think the right approach, you know, like we've both been basically saying, is not to get too excited for this year. Don't get your hopes up too much. You know, if they make it past the round of 32, I mean, that's all gravy from that point. Just get to the tournament, hopefully win at least one game, and anything beyond that, that's just fantastic. So, yeah, especially considering expectations going into this year. I wasn't expecting a great deal, so pleasantly surprised so far. Go Terps. And, you know, we'll be – I don't know what we'll talk about going forward here, Rob. I guess some more college basketball, some NBA. Obviously, we'll get more into the Orioles and baseball as the season approaches. Any last word here before we leave?
Well, and don't forget, Mike, we're only a couple of months away from really getting into that NFL draft talk, too.
Oh, boy. I'm so excited. Yeah. All right. So with that said, I think it's time to end this episode. Hope everyone enjoyed it. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week.